welcome to episode the 48th of the Internet's one and only podcast about comic books, Crying in the Book Club. We killed the last one and then replaced it with something new and better in some ways, potentially worse in others. One of the ways it's worse is that they kept me around. I'm your host. I'm Jean-Luc. One of the ways it's better is that we kept Emily and Alex, who are both here. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
Hello, Alex.
It doesn't make sense because you were on the old show. So how would you staying here make it worse? It would make it the same.
I got worse over the years.
Oh, you got worse. Well, we've all gotten worse.
No, I don't know if we've all gotten worse, but I've definitely gotten worse.
So Emily has cool, well, always cool hair, but cool.
Oh, Emily's hair has gotten a lot better. Emily's hair is so sick.
I was trying to not say cooler, but it's cooler. That's it.
It has gotten exponentially cooler.
It is strictly better than Emily's previous hair.
It's true.
I mean, it's mostly the same. Hair is, but
yeah,
it's all the same colors, but done differently in a way that looks much cooler. That was my stylist.
In the way that Brian Vaughn wrote Why the Last Man and Saga. Both by Brian K. Vaughan, but one.
I wouldn't compare Emily's previous.
I'm sorry,
hair
that's really rude to your old.
Last man. Yeah, my last hair was still pretty good.
It's more like a Paper Girls to Saga type deal, right? Like they're both pretty good, but one of them is clearly, you know, the magnum opus.
Yes,
and this may be the magnum opus of Emily's stylist. I don't know.
I think so.
Well, this is the going away party, right? This is the I'm leaving.
Oh yeah, I mean that was gonna be my cry space, but
that's okay.
Alex ruined it.
Yeah, this is the last time you guys are gonna get to see anything in the background of my office for a little while because after today I'm gonna be packing up all of my various bits and bobs all around my office. So it's gonna be pretty barren behind me next time.
It'll look more like the background.
Yeah, it'll look more like your office. It'll look more like where you record from.
My studio apartment. There's wow. No other. Well, I could record it. I could record from the couch. Maybe I'll do that next time.
Maybe save it for the big 50th episode in
luxurious
in a month. We have
big
50. Which
we are coming up on that big 50.
I recorded from a couch once last year when we had Chad on. I think it was for when we did God Country, and Chad said I looked like I was in an Al-Qaeda prisoner video from the 2000s. Or something to that effect. That might not have been exactly what he said, but it did.
I do remember like this.
Sounds pretty real. I think my weirdest one was in a closet at Disney World.
Uh-huh. Didn't you record from a bathroom once on the old show?
Yeah, but I feel like, I don't know, Disney World closet is... Anyone can record from a bathroom. Oh, no, that was, I think in that recording, I was in the bathroom, and then someone had to use the bathroom, so I went to the closet.
I've never recorded from anywhere weird, because anytime I'm somewhere weird, we just don't record. I should change that. We should make plans to record, and I won't tell you guys that I'm somewhere weird.
You should do it on the road next time. You're on the way, you're driving.
I've recorded a podcast while driving before, but I wasn't like... I wasn't manning the controls, but we did have we had a microphone between us and we were like talking while I was driving.
See, I feel like that'd be fun. You go on a road trip with a bud and then you're just recording it for content.
Yeah, I mean it was pretty fun.
And then you don't post it.
You just have a conversation with
you
your
tricked
friend.
Them, but you don't tell them that you didn't post them. You just know that they never watch the show, right? Yeah. Anyway.
It's like Chad.
Yeah.
We could never post our episodes with Chad. He'd be none the wiser.
Nope.
But wait, did you have something else to say? One of you interjected and then I cut you off.
Walking
Dead? Are we walking slowly to the Walking Dead?
I noticed Alex's really funny display name in the call in the middle of the theme song earlier.
Uh-huh.
It says, I'm walking here.
I'm walking here. That's what they
do.
Sounds
pretty good.
Should have set the book in New York for that exact reason.
Oh, man. Just imagine The Walking Dead in New York. I'm sure they have a spinoff that does answer that exact question, but like just a lot of people.
Well, we kind of get a sense for that. Right? I mean, New York's a much bigger city than Georgia, but I can't imagine it went much better.
The city of Georgia.
Atlanta.
I knew what you meant.
Brain machine broke.
The big we're talking about The Walking Dead.
We're talking about The Walking Dead. Have you guys heard of The Walking Dead? Small little indie comic. Sold 7,000 copies once back in the day.
You know what's crazy? Is like it's called The Walking Dead, and you're like, well, maybe it's about the zombies, but I think really the people left around are kind of The Walking Dead, you know? It's
That's pretty profound.
Did you read the letters column from issue 2 of The Walking Dead where
I can't afford that. I'm trying to pay for a wedding. That's too expensive too.
I read these through Comixology Unlimited, and the version of the volume doesn't have any breaks between the issues. It's like a totally seamless reading experience through the volume.
Ooh, that's what the omnibus does.
So you don't see like the letter, you don't see the letters or anything.
Unlike you plebs who read it, you know, Alex owns the big compendium thing. Emily, you got it from Comixology Unlimited. Me, I have an old hard drive from 2011 with the .cbr files for issues 1 through like 80 something.
It's not piracy if it was 13 years ago. That's just collecting.
Well, I'm not saying I pirated them. I'm just saying I have a hard drive with the .cbr files.
That's what I'm saying.
1 through like 84 of The Walking Dead. It's
I actually have physical copies of these comics, but I would have had to like dig them. I'm pretty sure they're actually packed up already, like because Gwen has basically packed up all of our books and DVDs and stuff. So I would have had to dig them out from somewhere. And since I mean, you know, it's free on Comixology Unlimited, I was like, yeah.
I didn't read it from my compendium because it was too heavy. So
You did read it from your compendium, or you read it from your tablet?
My tablet. It's a black and white tablet, which just works out perfectly for
the Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Perfect. You can't read any other comics on it. But no, you can read The Walking Dead.
You can read manga.
Holy Terror That's is true. Hard to read on it. It just doesn't you don't get the same
Alex really cares about the sanctity of reading Holy Terror. I want it the way Frank Miller intended. God damn
it. I feel like reading All-Star Batman would also be pretty difficult.
The Green Lantern issue would not make much sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of Frank Miller, Robert Kirkman wrote The Walking Dead. See, actually, you could read Sin City, right? Because, Sin City does have some splotches of color. Oh, is that a panel from Holy Terror? Thank you for that, Alex.
Yeah, it was worth it.
I appreciate it.
I made it 3 pages in, so that was like a month
ago. Why would you? You know, you once you start something, you have to finish it.
Oh,
That's not true at all.
That's why I read 100 and something.
You read all The Walking Dead. Oh,
shoot. I finally finished it after all these.
How does this thing end? I guess we can get to that later. We should figure out how
it's. I don't know how it ends. I've never read that. But yeah, The Walking Dead was co-created by Robert Kirkman and Tony Moore, who. One of those guys went on to become very famous. I guess Tony Moore is probably pretty famous too, just because his name's in the credits for the TV show. But they had previously worked on the Battle Pope series together, which I don't know if it was Kirkman's first comic, but it was definitely one that I think started getting him noticed.
I'm pretty sure it was like his first, like his breakout, like his first like real project.
I can see that. I've never read it, but I know about it by reputation. So The Walking Dead, obviously, comic book about zombies. Despite what Alex said, there are, you know, literal walking dead in addition to the human characters who are, you know, dead men walking, as the saying goes. Interestingly, the series was originally pitched to be a sequel to Night of the Living Dead. Because I'm sure this is a pretty widely known fact, but through some quirk of the distributor, Night of the Living Dead has basically been in the public domain since it came out. Mm-hmm. Because the distributor fucks up, which, you know what, I'm all for that. Like, more stuff should be in the public domain. And that initial pitch was rejected, and then went through a number of different iterations, including Emily. Do you want to say your fun fact about The Walking Dead?
Yeah. So I didn't know this until recently when I watched like a random video on YouTube about Robert Kirkman, which is how we ended up reading Invincible. And then now this is that I watched one random video about Robert Kirkman. I didn't know until recently that when they were pitching The Walking Dead to Image, they originally told the execs at Image that this was, because the Image was not really sold on the idea of doing like a straight up horror comic. They like were not really about it. Horror comics are always kind of a gamble, honestly, because it's a little more niche than other genres of comic book. But Image was not buying it. So Kirkman tells them, we're going to reveal that the zombies are actually a result of like an alien or like a plot by aliens to like weaken the earth to take it over. And this was not true. This was a lie at the time that he said it, and he never intended to go through with that. But Image bought it, and then they just never did that. Well, okay, they did do it in the April Fool's issue, which I didn't know. I also didn't know about until you told me that, John.
Yeah. It's also very funny that he said that while he was publishing Invincible at Image Comics, a book that is about a secret alien plot to take over the Earth.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that the alien pitch actually got rejected as well, and it wasn't until he retooled it to have the, you know, sheriff wakes up from a coma a month into the zombie apocalypse that it actually, you know, finally got approved.
You might be right. I was cribbing from a video I watched months ago, so
well, I was reading interviews with Robert Kirkman, so
yeah,
one of us is closer to the source. I called I called my boy Bob, and I was like,
Bob K,
so tell me about this Walking Dead thing. And he said to me on the phone, he said he wanted to write a real heartfelt, quiet, personal story. That he didn't say that to me on the phone, but he did say that about The Walking Dead. And he was really concerned that, to Emily's point, Kirkman was actually really concerned that people were going to just write the book off because it was a horror comic. Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that, you know, horror comics are a huge part of the medium's history in the West, they had basically been non-existent for like 40 or 50 years at this point because of the CCA, mm-hmm. and, you know, superheroes in general kind of being the dominant cultural force. But eventually he got it published, and it debuted in October of 2003 and ran for 16 years until the end of 2019, when Kirkman just surprise ended the series. Like, there were no it did not say last issue or anything in the solicitations. It was not until the issue came out that people knew, oh, The Walking Dead, it's over now.
I do think it's kind of hilarious that it ends on like issue 193. Like, you couldn't make it another 7 issues, bud.
You just didn't want to. He was tired of it.
His intro is literally in the book. He's like, this book's going to go on forever and ever. This will be the longest zombie comic ever. And then he's like 192, 193.
It is the longest zombie comic ever, I'm pretty sure.
I guess.
It's interesting because he's talked that way. He talked that way about Invincible as well for a long time, that he wanted Invincible to sort of go on forever. But I think then he kind of ran into the problem of, oh, I sold my two big IPs to streaming companies, and I need new IPs to sell to the streaming companies. But I mean, maybe it also has it probably also has something to do with the fact that, like, you have to just get tired of writing the same stories over and over for the better part of 20 years and want to do something new. So
sure.
When The Walking Dead debuted, it kind of bucked the trend of comic sales at the time, which is still the trend now. Comics traditionally do this thing where, like, issue one will debut really strong for pretty much every book, and you'll see a really significant drop off for issue two. And that happened for The Walking Dead. There's a big drop from issue one to issue two, but as early as issue three, the sales were already starting to recover. For context, issue one sold some around in the ballpark of 7,000 copies. Issue 2 sold a little over 6,000. Issue 3 sold around 6,800. And then by the end of the first arc and the start of the second arc, they were selling over 10,000 copies consistently. And that trend just continued. Like, the if you go back and look at comic book sales for like 2003 through like 2007, every month it just grows and continues growing in sales, which is to say nothing of like the trade sales on top of that. Actually, one of the interesting things in one of the letters is that there was an issue, I guess, where people got on the book late and were having trouble finding issue two because it sold out because they didn't print enough copies and it didn't get a second printing. Kirkman says the exact issue when he's responding to this letter. I think it's maybe issue six or seven. Whatever month issue six or seven came out is when they finally got around to reprinting issue two. So I think there were maybe a bunch of people who were just like, well, I don't know. I missed whatever happened there. I would like to come back. And yeah, the series, obviously, like, I don't need to talk too much about like the popularity of the series. I think like everybody knows Walking Dead is like a huge cultural juggernaut now.
Oh, yeah.
More so because of the TV show than the comic, but the comic is still immensely popular. And was even before it was adapted.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting with issue seven, Tony Moore, who was the co-creator of the series, is replaced on art by Charlie Adlard. And Adlard draws the book through the end of the series. Tony Moore drew covers through issue 24 and then left the book entirely. And then years and years later, like I think around the time of the TV show, Charlie Moore sued Robert Kirkman over unpaid royalties because I guess they had like a handshake deal over what Charlie Adlard would get after he, or what Tony Moore would get after he left the book. They did end up, I think the thing that like Tony Moore claimed that Robert Kirkman had promised him 60% of all the royalties associated with the comic, with comic book sales. And then they settled it outside of court, so we don't really know how that ended up happening, how that ended up shaking out, but presumably Robert Kirkman cared way more. I mean, I have to imagine the royalties associated with the TV show were just, like, dwarf the comics, and he could just be like, you know what, buddy? Sure.
Yeah, it said 60% of comic publishing net proceeds and 20% of motion picture net proceeds.
Yeah.
So I don't know if motion picture is movies or... Is it like
I think it's movies?
TV shows
and, I think
don't
it's
count.
Both.
Yeah, probably covers TV too.
Then he's rich.
Yeah, they had a they figured it out. I don't know much more about that. I don't know exactly what happened behind the scenes. I couldn't really find much on it either. You know, I don't need to know the drama, Robert Kirkman's drama with his childhood friends over comic book royalties. But anyway, I will get into the plot summary a little bit. For the listeners, we read the first two volumes of The Walking Dead, which is issues 1 through 12. A lot of this will be familiar to most people. I feel like most people have like read some amount of The Walking Dead, at least like the first few trades, or at least know the bare bones of the plot from the
TV
like
show. If you're into comics, you've probably like... You probably have a little bit of familiarity with The Walking Dead.
But I'll go through it anyway. I mean, the opening is, it opens on this shootout between a couple of police officers and this third guy who shoots one of the police officers. We later find out that is the protagonist of the series, Rick Grimes. And the story really starts when he wakes up a month later from a coma and he's alone in a hospital room. And then he sort of stumbles out of the hospital, finds it overrun by zombies who had not made it to, his room yet. They had also been barricaded, I think, in like the cafeteria or whatever. But Rick escapes the hospital. He heads home to try to find his wife and son, Lori and Carl. And instead, he meets a man named Morgan and Morgan's son. Morgan explains to Rick what has transpired, that, you know, about a month ago, zombies started showing up. Who knows why? I mean, eventually you find out why, but nobody knows right now. And issue one ends with Rick setting off to Atlanta, where he believes he can find his wife and son. When he arrives there, he finds the city completely overrun by zombies, and he comes very close to just getting rolled, but is saved by Glenn, who is scavenging the city for supplies. And he takes Rick back to a camp outside the city And there, Rick is, you know, through a kind twist of fate, reunited with his son and wife, as well as his former partner, Shane. There's all this introduces like a whole cast of characters, some of whom stick around for a while, some of whom don't, but I'll run through them briefly. There's Dale, there's Andrea and Amy, who are sisters, Donna and her husband, Alan, as well as their two kids, and then Carol and her daughter, Sophia, and a guy who's on his own named Jim. Rick kind of comes to the conclusion pretty quickly that they don't want to stay this close to Atlanta because they don't want to be in the proximity of the zombies, which leads to him butting heads with Shane, who is still of the belief that the government's going to come and fix it all, and they want to be as close as they can so they can be rescued quickly. Not long after their disagreement, a roaming group of zombies passes through their camp. They kill Amy, and Jim is bitten but not killed. Obviously, he does end up dying. When you get bitten in The Walking Dead, you turn into a zombie as well, which is very, you know, classic zombie stuff. And then things come to a head between Rick and Shane. They have a confrontation out in the woods, and Rick's shunt son, Carl, shoots Shane in the neck before he can hurt Rick, and that results in Shane obviously being killed. Now that he's out of the way, the group moves on. We get a brief flashback to Shane and Lori having sex after arriving in Atlanta, and that leads right into flashing back to the present, where Lori tells Rick that she's pregnant. We don't know if it's Shane's or Rick's. It is kind of a point of contention for a little bit.
We don't ever know, huh?
We learn.
I don't remember.
I think we know. Maybe we don't ever know for sure, actually.
What I meant was, like, is it ever spelled out specifically one way or the other? Like, obviously the timeline, like, it makes more sense for one answer than the other, but I was just curious if, like...
Yeah, I don't remember. It's been a long time since I've read past these issues.
Yeah.
Some recollection that, like, they do spell out that it would have been Shane. Spoilers, the kid never born.
Mm-hmm. Well, she is. Is she not?
No. I'm pretty sure they both die in... Oh, no, maybe I'm thinking of the show, because in the comic she is born, and then they both... But she's like, she gets insta-killed, right?
She's like a zombie kid.
It's not insta-killed, but she does get killed, I think.
Yeah, but it's pretty quick, though, because it's when... It's like the big, like... Whatever the famous
the prison, issue where right?
the governor kills like half of the main cast. But yeah, that is true. She does
so she lives and she is Shane's daughter. Okay. And so Michonne, who we don't know yet, we haven't met yet, ends up raising her in the future. And Rick lets her know that he's actually the daughter.
Dude, so. I don't remember. I do not remember that at all. But
neither.
I believe you. But yeah, Michonne doesn't show up for... Yeah, that's all way in the future. Before they get there, they meet Tyrese and his daughter, Lori, and Lori's boyfriend, Chris. They kind of fold them into their group of survivors. They end up finding what they think is sanctuary in this gated community. They spend a night there where they're like chilling. Oh my God, everyone gets their own nice little house. There's all kinds of like canned food here. This rocks. We're chilling. And then they go looking for supplies the next morning, and they find out that the community is overrun with zombies.
Yeah, they find sanctuary, but is sort of just the running, like...
Yeah.
That's going to just happen every time.
Yeah, it happens. It happens a lot. As they try to escape, Donna is killed, which sends her husband, Alan, spiraling into a fit of grief. The rest of them make it out, and they sort of pause for Rick, Tyrese, and Carl to go out hunting to try to find food. And while they do that, Carl is shot by another man in the woods who turns out to be this guy named Otis, who tells Rick and Tyrese about a farm where he lives with a veterinarian who can help save Carl. Rick takes Carl there immediately while Tyrese goes back to the group and brings them all to the farm, where they meet Herschel, who is a veterinarian, but is able to remove the bullet and stabilize Carl and he seems pretty chill. He's like, yeah, you guys can all just hang out here. Well, he gets better because they can't really move him in this state. Pretty quickly, it gets revealed there. Here comes the butt that Emily mentioned. Turns out Herschel is keeping like a dozen zombies in his barn because he thinks, you know, they're fine. I don't want to kill them, including like his neighbors and one of his sons who had died and been reanimated. There's a zombie that sort of wanders onto the farm and Rick wants to kill it, but Herschel says no and tries to navigate it into the barn, which doesn't end well on account of the, you know, dozen zombies that are in the barn who escape and they kill Herschel's living son. And finally Herschel comes to his senses and he along with, you know, the rest of the group kills off all of those zombies. A lot of the damage in the relationship here has already been done. Herschel kind of comes, gives him the ultimatum that they have to, that he wants them off his farm. He has to focus on his family. So everybody is everybody from that original group who survived is kicked out and they head on to the next location. The one exception being Glenn, who stays behind because he has started sleeping with Maggie, Herschel's daughter. And you know what? Good for him. There's a great little conversation where he's like, man, I just want to get fucked before, you know, I die. I don't want to die a virgin in the zombie apocalypse. And Maggie's like, oh, yeah, same here. I think she just says, do you want to fuck me? And then, you know.
No, she says, I'll fuck you. Yeah, she literally just says, I'll fuck you.
You're right.
She's like, if you want, like, no big either way.
It's not, it's like, both of them are kind of like, we got to try this before the end. And you know.
And then suddenly 5 minutes later, they're in love.
Yeah, they're in love with each other. Good for them. Teens. You know.
I was giggling because in your notes you made a typo and you said Glean stays behind with Maggie, and I thought that I liked that and I thought it was funny.
And then yeah, that's where the second arc, well, the second arc actually ends with them discovering a prison, which they are able to think that they're going to be able to turn into a semi-permanent home, and they're sort of looking over it from the hills. And then everything goes well from that point. From what I remember.
Yeah,
it's just great from that point on.
The government comes to help very soon, I think.
There's like six issues of them chilling in the prison, and then it's like the government shows up, and the rest of the series is about them like
rebuilding society.
I do like the prison issues because it's a little bit like they're in high school again, because you know it's kind of got the high school, you know, like all the comics and all the shows, they do like a high school arc or something, and it's like, oh, cute, it's good. But one of the students is a zombie, but they don't know who's the zombie, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's cute.
The Walking Dead, if it was a CW show.
Yeah.
All right. Well. Now that we're through all of that, I'm curious. I know both of you probably have history with The Walking Dead. I have some sense of what it is for both of you, but I am curious to hear it in your own words.
I didn't really know much about The Walking Dead until the TV show was announced. And, the very first announcement, like, because I was hanging out in comic book shops at the time. So when the TV show got very first announced, that was all people were talking about for a while. So I was like, well, I gotta check this out. So I read a whole bunch of The Walking Dead. I have a whole, like, I have so many of those, like, huge, like, big volumes that they put out, like, hardcover volumes that they put out. And I don't remember where I left off, but at some point I just, like, this was, like, right after high school, so I could, like, kind of get my parents to buy the comics for me sometimes, but then at a certain point they were like, you gotta start using your own money for this, and I was like, well, these are expensive, so I just sort of fell off reading them because I had to buy them. But I watched the first season of the TV show. I really liked the comic. I just never picked it back up. but I watched the first season of the TV show, and I didn't like how much it diverged from the comic. Not even for any particular, like, it wasn't that the changes were bad. I just was, like, irritated that they changed things, because that's the type of person I was at 18. I think I was 18 when the show came out. And so I never watched any more of the show after the first season. And, but yeah, that's my history with The Walking Dead.
Alex, how old were you when the first season of The Walking Dead came out?
2010, probably? 2009?
2010, I think.
14? Yeah, probably just starting high school.
Yeah, I think I was still in middle school when it came out.
Yeah, I have a vivid memory of watching it at my friend's house. But this time it was season two.
Yeah, it was 2010.
Oh, okay. It was season two was out, like just out, and we were like, it was on Netflix. And it was like late at night, and we were like having a sleepover. And then it was like, oh, you know, it's The Walking Dead. I'm like, oh, that's scary. I don't know. And then we watched a few episodes, and it was like, oh, like it was scary, but it was like very, I need to watch the next episode though. And then I think we just finished season two, and I never watched any more until like a month ago when I watched the first episode again. But in between those two times, I read the 98 issues of the comic, which is the two big compendiums, because I got them on sale at Fan Expo in different years.
So yeah, it's like half.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, just under half of the whole thing. Like the part where it ends is the big Glenn part. So that happened. Or maybe does it happen? I don't know. I'd have to reread it.
I think it's right before, because I think that's issue 100.
Okay, yeah. So it's getting set up, and they're at the place with that guy, the governor.
Negan, yeah.
Doing things. But yeah, I just remember the book being like very, very page turny, very like, there's a lot of dialogue in this book, but it's like, it's so soap opera-y, and I think in a way that kind of works with comics, even though like there were times when I was reading these ones and I'm like, there's a lot of writing and there's a lot of like text bubbles that the art doesn't really have a chance to do anything. And then, you know, there's some zombie stuff that goes on. So it, like, I understand why they did turn this into a TV show, because it kind of feels perfect. Like, just take the dialogue, add a little more to it, and you're kind of set.
I do kind of want to loop back to that at some point, because I have thoughts on the how much dialogue there is in this book.
Tony Moore was not involved. The reason there's an issue with Tony Moore is because he doesn't really do that much. Like, it's all faces. I don't know, Tony. Yeah,
it's just copy pasting faces over and over. Well.
That does happen a few times.
Robert Kirkman is fucking yapping. Yeah, I also got into The Walking Dead because of the TV show. I think by the time I got into it, season two was airing. And so I watched season one and like half of season two before I read any of the comics. But this was not that long after I had started reading comics. This would have been like 2012, I think. So I would have just gotten into the New 52, probably not even a year beforehand. And I really liked the TV show at the time, the first season especially. And so I went and I read everything that I had missed, which I don't remember exactly. Well, it was issue like 80, up to issue like 80 something at that time. And then I read it monthly all the way through, I think, 2015 or 2016 even. Wow. Whenever the All Out War arc ended is about when I dropped off of reading it monthly.
Okay, so it looks like I made it to like issue 73.
Oh, okay.
So I made it pretty far in.
Yeah, that's I mean, that's not
quite... That's farther than I thought.
That's not quite when they start introducing Negan, but you're, like, pretty close to that part of the story.
Yeah, because I didn't know anything about Negan when he was announced for the TV show, so...
Yeah, but, I mean, you got pretty close, yeah. That's cool. So, all of us have read a lot of The Walking Dead before. I knew both of you had read some of it, but I didn't know, Emily, that you had gotten that far.
Yeah, I didn't think I had gotten that far.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, yeah. So, yeah, that's our histories with it. I still have not, during the pandemic, I was like when we were, well, when we were in lockdown, I thought about going back and finally finishing it, but I never did. And I don't know if I will. I kind of just stopped being interested.
Yeah, for me, there's more after than what I've, like, I've read 98 issues and there's still more than 98 issues left. And it's like,
not that much though. Like I did the math and it's only, I did the math and like, I think it's like 96 issues that you have left. So.
Oh. Oh, cause it ends at 180. Oh, yeah.
190.
Wait, let me do that again.
193 minus 96.
Cause nine.
Okay, oh, no, so yeah, maybe it is nine. Oh, it was 97.
It's almost, you made it to almost exactly the halfway.
Yeah, you were almost exactly halfway.
If you read half of the next issue, you would have made it to the halfway.
See, it's too much. I if it was half, I'd go for it, but it's just.
I think I only have like 60 issues left because I think it's like I read until maybe early 130s, late 120s, but it's still like, it's daunting. It's a daunting amount of issues.
Yeah. I think at the point where I stopped, I was sort of like, the characters remaining. Other than, you know, Rick's Rick, you know, he is, but like, I felt like a lot of the characters that I liked were either dead or moved on, or like, it was just, and all these new people. And, you know, I knew about the Glenn twist by then, because I think it had already happened in the TV show by the time I read it. So,
Oh, really? So yeah. Wait, you must have read it somewhat recently then, like within the last 5 years.
I feel like I picked up I picked up the Omni. I must have known it. From the maybe I knew that it happened in the comics then, like someone there, because got in like 20,
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. It was
2018, 2017 was Compendium 2, I would think.
Yeah. And it happened in 2015. This is so tangential, but yeah, 2015, I think. Yeah, I think I kind of dropped off of it because like the Negan stuff was very similar to the Governor stuff. It was just like ramped up to a million. In terms of like,
oh, Negan's not the Governor, right?
No, they're two different.
No, characters. Yeah. Those are two different characters.
In a way, it kind of reminds me of like in like a shonen anime, like when they defeat like one big bad, but they have to like keep the series going, so they just have to be like, they basically reinvent the last bad guy, but they just gotta like pump him up.
See, Star Wars doesn't have that problem. They just bring back the Emperor.
Somehow the Governor has returned.
Yeah. Well, he actually does return in that Alien issue. A lot of the dead characters show up again. I think Shane shows up again.
That's a cool way to do
issue.
It.
I wish I could remember off the top of my head what issue number it is, because it is a fun issue.
Forgot to mention in my history of The Walking Dead that I also at one point attempted to read the Walking Dead prequel novel Rise of the Governor, I had to stop reading that book because there is a scene in it where there is a sexual assault and it is described from the perspective of the one doing the assault, and it was very upsetting, and I just could not bring myself to get back into the book after that. So
yeah, that's tough.
Robert Kirkman, like, what is your deal, bro? The sexual violence, bro?
Did you guys see, there was a tweet that went kind of viral on Twitter, a comics Twitter this week, that was it was a picture from like a convention of a bunch of like single issues for sale that were like really expensive prices. And the point of the tweet was like, the new Ultimate Spider-Man, the first printing, is already going for $150 on the secondary market, which is like insane. Because it came out like 3 months ago. But in that picture, if you look at the other things that are there, one of them that is also going for like $150 is the Invincible issue where Mark is assaulted. And it is described in the little insert that is like written on it. Because like they say like Hawkeye first appearance, Thanos helicopter, et cetera, et cetera. It literally just says Invincible rape issue. And then the price of $100.
That checks out with what I've seen in some art, like not artist alleys, but exhibitors, where there's just like, yeah.
Oh yeah, like artist alleys are great. Exhibitors often make me want to set them on fire.
Yeah, I my stomach turned a little bit when I saw
it. I have the first Kiss issue of Superman and Wonder Woman.
Aw, that's nice.
It's probably worth like $20.
But it's invaluable.
Exactly. But if someone does want to buy it, let me know.
Hit him up on Twitter, at Alex Anzalek.
Robert Kirkman in Sexual Violence is, like, it's so weird, and it just, it's a pattern across, like, both of the series that we have read with him, even though I haven't actually gotten to that part in Invincible, I'm, like, familiar with it. I just, I don't know, it's just, like, can you not think of other ways to show that people are evil? And I think the answer is no, not really, aside from brutally killing people. Like, the only other way to really, like, the way that a character is most demonstrably shown to be evil is if they commit some sort of, like, sexual assault or, like, some other weird sexual transgression. I'm thinking about the governor and his, like, little pet zombie. That's the governor, right?
That is the governor. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm. But anyway, yeah.
Because in this book, there's a part where, like, someone's like, "I thought my neighbor was good, but then he tried to rape my daughter."
That's what I'm thinking about. Because
people are bad.
Yes.
And it's like, you don't need this, but go ahead.
Well, I actually think so. That scene, like, there is, like, a thing in that scene that I think is good, which is that it's Tyrese who says that, I think, and then he goes on to say, like, the thing that really fucked him up about that was not even because they're talking, he's talking about how he killed the neighbor, and then he says the thing that, like, really horrified him was that he didn't feel bad about killing him at all, which I think is kind of an interesting thing that this book plays with a little bit, but I don't think it ever really,
it has the thing with Carl too. I mean, it's a one-off, but it's like when he shoots Shane, he's like, that feels different than the zombies.
Yeah, Carl, like, says that at the end of issue six. Like, yeah. It is a real thing in the book that I think there is a way that Kirkman does kind of get to the interiority of these characters and the way that they're kind of disgusted by the status quo of the world that they're in. And not necessarily that, like, that makes them evil or whatever, but I do think that there's, like, some good notes in that respect as well.
It's just another way that, like, a lot of these comics are extremely written in 2003.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Which, this isn't as bad as, like, reading Brian K. Vaughan books from that era. We don't see people throwing around slurs.
Yeah, it's interesting how like, woke Walking Dead is. Like, if this came out now, it would
you're right.
Like, it would 100% be described as woke, because, like, no one uses slurs. It's like a multicultural, multi-ethnic cast.
Yeah.
There's, like, lines in there about, like, some of the women being upset about how they're being treated in the apocalypse, where they're, like, just being asked to do, like, domestic labor while their husbands go off and hunt. And there's, like, a letter. I'm sorry to keep going back to the letters, but I was fascinated by, I read all the letters columns for these.
You said, like, it was not included in my book at all. So,
yeah, there's a letter that Robert Kirkman gets in one of the later issues of what we read. And it's from a guy who says, like, I'm an African-American fan. And it's, like, really awesome that you have multiple black characters in the book, because there's, like, no black characters in comics.
Yeah. It's, like, at this time, especially.
Yeah. And Kirkman's response is, like, kind of tongue in cheek and funny, because he's like, I made the main black character a former NFL player, and he immediately fell in love with the white woman. I'm perpetuating stereotypes. Which I think is, like, kind of like a failed attempt at sort of edgy humor, but also, like, feels in, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek. Like, it's, I think it, Kirkman's having fun. Kirkman, like, reading the letters columns, like, Kirkman seemed like he was, like, really into all of the stuff at the time.
He
seemed like he was really enjoying writing the book, which is cool.
I do vaguely recall having read some criticism about the comic in regard, like, with Robert Kirkman and race and, like, how he handles stuff related to race, but it would have been so long ago that I don't remember, like, any of the points about it, but apparently there has been a bit of discourse, but not so much that it, like, permeated the popular conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a point to be made that, like, and this is, like, more general. It's not specific to, like, the race stuff. Everyone in this book kind of talks in the same way. Rick has, like, kind of this extra thing going on where he's very stable, or he's portrayed as being very stable. And then everybody else kind of is, like, constantly, like, talking in the same kind of tone, is something that I felt from these rereading these issues.
Or when he tries to write characters talking a little differently, it comes across really clumsy.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of really stilted dialogue in this book. Basically, anytime something bad happens to one of the characters, every other character is all of a sudden moralizing to them about how they shouldn't be feeling grief right now. And they almost always say the exact same things.
God, that fight between what's his face and what's her face. Like, you
wow,
know.
You
Herschel got... and Herschel and.
No, Andrea yeah. and Alan, right?
Yes.
The one who's he has two kids and his wife died.
Yeah, his wife died.
Yeah, that's Alan, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that the one where she's like, you should live for your kids? And he's
like
don't
tell
me you haven't been through
this. Like, I feel like she has some points, but she, like, comes off a super asshole about it.
Yeah.
I
don't know. Something about the way that she came at him in that scene just did not feel... It didn't feel natural to her character. It, like, felt like it kind of came out of nowhere. Like, I feel like the being strong for your kids thing is a good point, but I don't know. She's being a real dick about it.
It's especially bad characterization because she also had, like, just lost her sister.
Yeah.
And, like, I feel like she wasn't...
She mostly just uses that as, like, I know what I'm talking about because I just lost my sister.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird bit of characterization.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then with Herschel, right after his, like, son dies and all those people die, and they're all like, what do you mean you're cooking a show? What? Come on. It's been like a day and they're just like right on him about it. And it's just like I understand it is a life and death thing, but it just feels so like.
I don't know. I'm kind of on the opposite end where, like, I know that, like, Herschel definitely has valid reasons to be pissed off at them. And, like, I can't even blame him for feeling like things didn't start to go badly until these people showed up, even though that his situation was not tenable. This was going to happen eventually. And Rick is right that it probably would have gone much worse if they had not been there, because Herschel wouldn't have had the extra weapons to take care of the zombies when they inevitably broke out, because it just, they could not have kept that going. And so, like, I thought it was, like, really weird and abrupt, and that, like, Herschel was like, oh, I never intended for you guys to stay here. I just have to take care of my family. It just felt like something that was done because they have to go to a new location. They have to do something else now.
I actually think that bit of characterization kind of works for me, because I think Herschel is, like, kind of portrayed as being somewhat unstable prior to that. It's subtle because, okay, here's a guy who... stereotypically, like, okay, he's a farmer, he, like, kind of lives off the land, you're supposed, like, you kind of get lulled into this sense because of all the signifiers around his character that, like, he knows what he's doing and he's, like, a guy who can handle himself. But basically, as soon as you see him, that scene with him and Rick where he tells Rick that, oh yeah, I'm just keeping a dozen zombies in my barn, like, it's not a big deal. Basically, from that moment onward, there's, like, a couple other scenes that go with it, too, where you can tell this guy does not know what he's doing. This guy was, like, is prone to, like, mood swings and does not think about things rationally.
I don't know, like, just the way that it played, not that it happened, but the way that it played out felt weird to me for some reason, you know?
That's fair.
I think both perspectives make sense. Like, obviously, like, you have your family here, and you found a place that is safe, except for he's keeping zombies in the barn. Like, come on, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But then at the same time, it's like, their son just died, and you're already moving into his bedroom kind of thing, like... He's not even cold in the ground. It's like...
That's fair. Rick being like, why do we have to stay in the barn when you all of a sudden have two bedrooms freed up, is pretty fucked up. I agree with that. Like, they shouldn't have tried to push that.
Yeah, I don't think Herschel should be kicking them out to I don't think it makes sense for them to be like, okay, go ahead, you're gonna go ahead and die, but like, you're going for the son's bedroom when he offered you the barn, and you're still asking for more. Like,
the pacing in this arc felt really rushed to me. I don't know if it came across that way to you guys, but like, it felt like reading it, I was like, yes, this is a logical progression of events. This is like, this all makes sense, but it seems like it's happening really quickly. And like, I don't know, like, something about it, like, it felt like the pacing didn't totally work for me.
I agree that it's fast and things happen really quickly, but I actually don't mind that for this arc. I kind of like the sort of place-to-place-to-place setup. Actually, even going forward in the series, some of my favorite parts of it are when, like, post-prison, when they're bouncing around again, because I like that. I like that it kind of gets at the sense of like danger in the world. Like, I like those kind of like post-apocalyptic stories where people are always like have to always be moving around and can't, because like the like sort of settling down is a little boring, I guess. And so I like Kirkman like establishes like that sense of danger.
I think they stay in the prison for like a while too, so like having them jump around before, like, I think they're in the prison till like in the 50s or something like that.
Yeah,
they're
in prison for a while.
It is kind of, I think this arc kind of reads better once you read the prison one too and have that like context, which I kind of there too, where it's like, because prison, you're there for the whole time you're there and thing, whereas, and it's like the reason they stay is because it's like they've been to so many places, and even when it looked good, they had to leave and stuff, and they finally have a thing. But yeah, it's, there's, I don't know when you want to get to it, or maybe we can get to it now, but like, the what did you guys think of like the text and the amount of talking people do, and like how it fits into the medium of comic books? Because that's like, you know, that's, dude,
my guy Robert Kirkman wanted to be a TV writer. You can fucking tell reading this book. I know that this was like a huge trend in the early 2000s of like comic book, like really dialogue heavy comics. And it was like a thing in not just like indie stuff, but superhero comics too. And like, obviously if like the dialogue is good, you kind of don't notice it as much. And like a lot of the dialogue here, like, yes, some of the characters do sound the same, but I think it's like pretty, it's pretty solid. But man, like the constant panels where you just like see two heads and then just like paragraphs of text.
It's unfortunately really easy to kind of just bounce around the text bubbles and not pay as much attention to the art.
I will give the lettering a lot of credit, in the sense that I never was like a lot of the time when there's this much text, like I feel like I read things in the wrong order, but that never happened here. Like, I felt like it's very clear, like the sequencing of it. But yeah, I agree with Emily that like you just barely focus on the art at all. And then I think the art is like not, I don't like it nearly as much as I remember. I remember The Walking Dead having a much kind of like rougher style to it. And I don't know how I got that impression, because like, this is like just basically one step up from like webcomic tier art.
It's very clean. Even the zombie stuff is like that's where you sort of get it. Cause they talk for a bit. Then a zombie comes and it goes.
I like the art actually. I like the use of like the gray tones. It to me, it looks a lot like Copic markers, which are like a type of like alcohol based like art marker that I like a lot. And it just like, I don't know, gives it a certain texture that I like. I like the art. I agree that I felt like, I feel like when I was reading it at like 17, 18, that I thought the art looked better then, but I wouldn't say it's a step above webcomic art, but I also like a lot of webcomic art. So I don't consider webcomic art an insult in as much as an indicator of like, you know, like saying something is like a webcomic would be implying that it's amateurish, and I don't think that this is amateurish.
No, it's just, it's a stylistic thing, and it's a style that I don't particularly care for.
Sure.
It's not that it's amateurish, because, like, obviously, like, I don't mean it in that sense.
Okay.
I do think it gets better.
I didn't mean to imply that that's what you were saying. That's just sort of like the connotation that I like felt from that word.
Okay, fair enough. I do think it's better when Adler takes over because it's not as clean. The Tony Moore issues all have that really, like, the faces are all like these really clean chiseled lines to them. I really don't like that. You can tell how much of the like coloring and shading is done digitally also.
Mm-hmm.
And digital art has gotten so much better since that, like, I'm talking about in Western comics, like,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes mm-hmm. like nowadays are pretty much everything is done digitally, but there are times when, like, you can't fully you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
That it's all done digitally. Whereas this is, like, very clearly, like, hand drawn and then digitally shaded, which,
yes,
I think is just like this weird, it gives everything like a weird texture at least in the initial issues. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's the Adler stuff is also digitally shaded, because I feel like by this time that was kind of the way it was done. Like, I think that was pretty industry standard even by 2003. But I think it just, for whatever reason, I think his style looks a lot better, even though it's, you
know. Yeah, it's the Adler art specifically that looks, that it has that, like, Copic marker look to it that I like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't dislike the first seven issues, but I agree that the art does step up when Adler takes over.
I will say, in favor of the writing, like, for this series, is that Kirkman is definitely one of those guys who, like, kind of like Brian K. Vaughan in this sense, that, like, it seems like he just instinctively knows how to structure, like, issue based storytelling.
Yes.
Like, every issue has, like, a three act structure to, like, an internal three act structure, and then ends on just, like, he's so good at cliffhangers as well. Which is something that I always think of that as being a, like, a Vaughn thing, which I think is another thing that does also come from, you know, television writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I think it's issue 7 or issue 8 that ends on, like, it's the whatever issue it is where they stay overnight at in the gated community, and then the snow starts melting, and it's just the shot of the outside gate where, and the snow melting off of the writing that's been etched on there that says "All dead, do not enter." Is just, like, that is, has to be, like, in the running for, like, an all-time great comic book cliffhanger.
Oh yeah.
Like, or at mm-hmm. least, like, maybe not all-time great, but, like, all-time, like, iconic comic book cliffhanger. It's just mm-hmm. it's incredible. Yeah. And so, like, that goes to, I think it was Alex who mentioned this earlier, that, like, it is really exciting to read the book, even if, like, moment to moment, I think they're, like, Kirkman is still ironing out, which is weird because this actually is after Invincible, and I think Invincible hits the ground running pretty well from a writing perspective, but this is, you know, I'd be curious to read more, because I wonder if my recollection that, like, Kirkman kind of irons out his writing style later on is true or not. But, like, even that, like, even setting that aside, like, reservations about that aside, it is, like, there is a lot of tension because of those cliffhangers. And it's always driven by, like, there's mm-hmm. some new reveal, there's some twist. And so it just makes it really exciting to read issue to issue.
Yeah, Kirkman really knows how to build tension. And, like, it really does make it fun to read, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, like, this book is, it's all tension hanging overhead that makes it work. And sure, some of the dialogue's not the best, but I think a lot of it does really succeed, and it does because it's just, like, you have that thing of, like, oh, a walker could come at any time, and maybe it's one, maybe it's 20, maybe it's 30, and anyone
can die. Sorry, yeah, Alex, finish, and then I have a question.
You know, just that in these first two volumes, I feel like they do a pretty good job of being, like, anyone can die. I mean, up to an extent, like, in the camp when there's that guy who says one word answers, you're like, that guy's fucking dead. He doesn't really want to live. He's going to get bitten and stuff like that. But like the amount of people they end up going through in this, it's like, oh wow, Shane's dead, or like, oh wow, this person's dead. And I don't really remember how that goes. I mean, obviously the Glenn stuff later, full spoilers, obviously, that's obviously, but like I don't know if it keeps going at that rate and stuff and people keep dying, but I seem to recall.
Yeah.
Like there's like that, they like I said, there's it's one of the issues. It's like the last issue when they're like escaping the prison. I remember when I got into comics and was like listening to like contemporary podcasts, and the issue had already come out at that point. I want to say it's like
there are other podcasts about comic books.
There were at the time, but the market has completely dried up in the time since then. People would refer to I used to know the issue number off the top of my head because people referred to it as like this mythical issue that was like in the way that people talk about like the Red Wedding from Game of Thrones when they,
it's the way people in the Utsuna fandom talk about episode 33.
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
I know, but look, that reference was relevant to probably at least one person listening. So that was for you, listener.
We love you.
But yeah, it's the issue where like Lori dies and I don't remember
I can like actually still like fully picture the page where Lori dies like in my head like over a decade later. Like I still vividly remember like turning to that page and that happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that issue and like maybe the issue before it have a bunch of people die and like they like
Game of Thrones is an apt comparison.
Yeah. It is kind of Red Wedding-esque. And also like in terms of the way that like they split all the characters off for like a lot of the survivors off for a while too. Like I want to say Rick and Carl are on their own for like a couple of stuff of that, but I don't.
I forgot that Negan was at the prison. He was the guy sort of doing that thing. Or is it the governor?
The governor's the governor. That's the governor. Yes.
Again, yeah, issue 48 is the
48, yeah. Yep. It's 48. And I want to say there's like maybe 47 and 49, but I can't remember exactly. But yeah, 48 is the kind of go-to issue there that people talk about. Alex, were you gonna was that what you were gonna say, your point about the feeling that the characters can die at any point?
Oh yeah.
Okay,
cool. But you don't really get into the superhero comics that I read
before. Definitely not.
This is not totally, I guess this is more about the TV show than it is about the comic, but it in comparison. But I wasn't there a thing with the TV I could have Googled this. Wasn't there a thing with the TV show where they like refused to use the word zombie and they would like only call them walkers or whatever?
They call them walkers, mm-hmm.
But I feel like there was like a, I don't know, like it was like a rule or a policy or something. They like didn't use the word zombie on the TV show. So, Maybe. So like, I remembered that like halfway through volume 2 when I noticed that they were using the word zombie. Yeah. And I just was wondering if either of you remembered that being a thing.
I do not remember that.
I remember being part of their marketing and stuff. Like I think it was part of the hype of the show where
these aren't zombies. Like, calling them walkers or whatever.
Yeah.
But they don't really call them that in the comic.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't. I just assumed it was in the comic, and I guess I never like paid attention. Like
they call them Rover. They call individual zombies that aren't like in groups or whatever. They call them roamers, but I don't remember seeing the word walker anywhere. But I do remember that being a big part of the show. Is that calling them?
I wonder if that's a later invention of the comic.
It
could be a little bit of a retcon then.
Yeah. Someone may have introduced walkers later down in the comic and they just decided to bring that into the show from the get-go.
Yeah, I actually, now that you mentioned that, I don't remember.
But I definitely don't remember seeing the word walkers when I was reading these two volumes.
Yeah, no. I don't remember it either. It might be in the comic later. I legitimately do not remember. Yeah. Well, we've talked about The Walking Dead for a long time. I just am looking at the recording to the recording timer. But
do you have any more questions?
I'm actually curious because this is what he said. He said I referenced this quote earlier, but in the letters column in issue three or issue two or three, whichever one has the first letters column, he responds to a question and he says, most people might see the gore and monsters and write Walking Dead off as a horror book. But I think this is the closest I will ever get to a real, heartfelt, personal, quiet story. I take this genre seriously. And so I'm curious if you guys think he achieved that goal of telling a heartfelt, quiet, personal story. And as a secondary question, based on this quote, was The Walking Dead the first ever elevated horror story?
To that last one, I, you know, not that I could tell you what would be considered the first elevated horror story, but no, I wouldn't say that this was the first. I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, that checks.
I wouldn't say that this was the first.
They didn't have horror movies with serious themes before 2018. Ari Aster invented that.
But I mean taking the first part of the question more seriously, there are moments in this book that I would say are quiet, and I think that this book uses quiet very well. Would I call the story quiet? Not really. There's a lot of people fighting and arguing, and like not getting along, and also saying a lot of things. I feel like talking is antithetical to the idea of quiet. And there is a lot of talking in this book, but I do think that you can tell that he's going for something real and heartfelt with this. I don't know that it 100% lands as much as he thinks it lands all the time, but it's not, you know, like it's still good. And I think that especially like it does, I remember it getting better as it went. I would have to reappraise that with eyes that are not as dazzled as I was at age 18. I mean, I do like that it's a human story set amongst the zombies rather than just being about the zombies, I guess. And it came during the zombie craze of the like 2000s, 2010s. But it was one of the properties that I think took zombies the most seriously of everything else that came out.
Another recurring theme in the letters column is that people are always asking him if he's read that Max Brooks book.
World War Z. I haven't read it either.
The zombie survival handbook.
What I meant. The zombie survival handbook.
Yeah. I think he also wrote World War Z though. Right? Either way. And there's like a bit in one of the letters where he's responding to it and he's like, we almost went a whole month without anyone bringing up 28 Days Later and you had to go and ruin it.
Look, in fairness, someone in
the brought up 28 Days Later.
In fairness, like there are, you know, if I had a nickel for every time a zombie story opened with somebody in a hospital having to escape and figure out what the hell is going on and then joining a group of people where things go horribly, I'd have two nickels, which is not very much, but it's weird that it happened twice.
It's a sick opening though. I see why they used it twice.
Yeah, like, it's not bad. It's a cool way to... I think there are enough like significant differences between the way 28 Days Later and the way that The Walking Dead play out that I wouldn't consider it, you know, like one trying to crib from the other. But, can't blame people for bringing it up.
They come out like 4 or 5 months apart from one another, I think.
I don't remember when 28 Days Later came out. So, but I have seen
that movie. It's 2003.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's the same year.
Oh, wow. So they came, that is even weirder that they both came out in the same year.
Yeah, yeah. And then Shaun of the Dead, I think, is 2004. So it's a big heyday for zombie stuff.
the 2000s were big on zombies.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that his quote is saying like, oh, most people, you know, write it off as a horror book. But and then he's like he's almost like diminishing the horror genre. And then at the end of his quote, he's like, but I love the horror genre and it's great. And it's like,
It's weird because like, I think he does like horror, but he wants to sell his book. And so, I think that's like where the disparagement comes in, is he like,
maybe
he doesn't think people take horror seriously. And so he feels like he needs to talk about it in terms that aren't sort of elevating the horror aspects of the book, but rather elevating the more human character aspects of the book.
Right.
Which I can't tell you what the cultural zeitgeist was like on that stuff at the time. Emily probably would have the best sense of the three of us. But like, I know like horror comics especially have kind of fallen out of favor for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's just poor phrasing, but
I can't think of very many horror comics that like people were talking about, have been talking about, other than The Walking Dead for the most part. It's been so long, but the Comics Code really just fucking like undercut the horror comics market, and it just has never really recovered.
I mean, yeah. It's like
it's Preacher,
horror in general does something. Not get a, like very much respect in any medium that it is being utilized. Like horror movies never win fucking awards at the Oscars. They're never most of the time never even nominated. And horror in general is often seen as like easy schlock. And I mean, there is a lot of really bad horror, so, you know, I get it.
I mean,
but also
the only other horror comics that I can think of, I think it's had kind of a resurgence since like the like Image boom from like the early 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
But like the only other horror comics aside from Walking Dead that I can think of like being critically acclaimed and like well-known before then are Preacher, which Alex mentioned. American Vampire.
Is Swamp Thing a horror comic? I feel like the more stuff is for the time.
Look, I mean, you could argue, but it's not like it's not straight up horror. It's still like
the Swamp Thing stuff does walk the line. There's some arcs, like there's a whole arc in the Moore Swamp Thing about like them. There's like a film company that wants to film a movie about like slavery on an old plantation, and it's like this really schlocky, like, you know, the slave and the owner fall in love with one another, and they end up being the people who work on the film end up being haunted by the ghosts of the slaves who imprisoned on that plantation. So I think it does get, like, I would say that book does go into like actual horror.
Hellblazer. Linked Hellblazer, okay, fine. But like,
but these are like
mainstream success.
These are not, aren't mainstream. Like Hellblazer is like well regarded, but it's, I don't think it was ever a sales juggernaut.
No, I don't think so.
No.
I mean, I guess Sandman, but Sandman's not really horror either. I mean, there's stuff that's like, but there's nothing that's like The Walking Dead is like, it is horror. Like, there's no Preacher. No, Preacher, you can say like, it's not really a horror book. Like, it has horror elements, but it's, you know, but you can't get away from the horror in The Walking Dead because it's about zombies, right?
Yeah.
So like, it's
is fundamentally a horror premise.
Yeah.
It's just, rather than talking about like a comic that has horror in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I guess just back to the quote about like a real heartfelt, quiet story. I think it does a good job of doing that. But at the same time, after two arcs, I like the characters in Invincible more, and I feel like
they're more
characters than in this, because this one you have so many people, and I feel like even Rick, I don't really like Rick in this thing. He's kind of a fucking, I don't know. He's Mr.
Just
protagonist,
kind of
but he's
King
so
protagonist.
He's bland. He's bland, and you got the side characters that are coming in, and I do remember liking them more as they went on, but they don't really feel like real characters that or like I don't really feel a reason to like these characters yet. We're like two arcs in, and
yeah,
I like Glenn.
I mean,
yeah,
I like Glenn getting, later like, on. Glenn on does yet. Not do much in these issues.
No, I don't know. I just like Glenn in general. Like him, I find him charming and adorable.
Yeah. I do think like Rick is definitely just there to be a cipher, basically. He's, you know, he's like a video game protagonist almost in a lot of ways. But like I think part of it is because like the rest of the cast does like kind of rotate because people die really rapidly. Yeah. So you don't get in these issues, you don't get as much of a chance to really, I don't know, get into the characters. It's weird because I do remember feeling really invested in a lot of characters at different points in the series, but I also remembered being invested in them way quicker because I kind of agree with Alex that like the human stuff is very like, it feels very cliched now. You know, not that that's always a bad thing, but it's like, I like soapy stuff. I mean, I watched seven seasons of Riverdale. You know, I'm not above like being into like CW tier soap operas or whatever that run forever. It's just a lot of it didn't click for me here in the way that I remember it clicking.
I think it's just like you have read more now and you've read more comics now, sure. That like going back and reading something like this, which like, what, you know, it's not Kirkman's first comic, but it is like fairly early in his career. I think just going back to this, like you can tell that he is a less experienced writer. And so there are some pitfalls in the writing where it's like, I can see a lot of potential here, but there are things that don't quite land the way that I can tell you're trying to make them land.
Totally. And although I do think what Alex brought up is interesting, that Invincible, which debuts a year before this, does feel more refined.
I wonder if that could come as a result of the fact that horror comics have been not as heavily in like the cultural comic sphere, because you could imagine that Kirkman would have probably just on average read more superhero comics than horror comics. So it would be something that he would have like more of a specific frame of reference for like kind of how to emulate in, like when I say emulate, I don't mean that he's copying anyone. You know what I mean? Like I feel like this is speculation, but I feel like theoretically, like he could have had more of a model for the pacing and writing of superhero comics versus horror comics. And so like this is maybe more of a newer thing to him. Does that make sense?
No. That's absolute. Mm-hmm. That absolutely makes a lot of sense. I mean, like there's already models at this point for like doing the sort of soap opera superhero. I mean, mm-hmm. like there's Claremont's X-Men, there's Wolfman and Perez Teen mm-hmm. Titans. So yeah, that's, I hadn't thought about that, but like, yeah, there are like direct models out there for what he was doing with Invincible, whereas horror comics didn't have that at all.
And I will say that, like, I mean, it is 10 years later, or, you know, it's like 8 years later, but the first episode of the TV show, I felt way more attached to the characters. And, you know, that's also a medium thing. You're given more time with them, but like Rick in the TV show in the first episode, you like really, it's basically the same thing. Like up until the point of, like, I think the first episode is maybe they meet up. I don't even think they meet up with Shane yet.
No, the first episode ends with...
It ends in the tank, right?
In the tank in Atlanta, yeah.
And he hears, like, a voice, and it's Glenn, and it's yes, like, who's that? Yes. Or, like, getting out. Yep. So, and really, like, it's
and just... And it has, Rick like, some horrible needle drop that I can't remember off the top of my head, but I remember hating it at the time.
Oh, I don't remember that
but,
at all.
But I really liked the first episode of the TV series. I still
yeah.
maintain that to this day, that it's really good.
I was kind of disappointed that a couple of the, like, iconic images that they use in the TV show didn't really... that, like, weren't in the comic. Specifically, like, what I'm thinking of is from the first episode. Like, there's the image footage of Rick riding the horse into Atlanta, like past all the cars. Like it's like a big wide shot of him on the horse, like with all the abandoned cars. I was kind of hoping there was gonna be like a splash page of that. Like you see him get the horse, but you don't really see like that moment. And also the scene with Glenn in the tank. I thought that the way that that scene played out was much cooler than the way that it plays mm-hmm. out in the comic, even though I don't think it's bad in the comic. It's just like the use of that tank set piece. I thought it makes it a much cooler scene.
You think that if it was going to be in one thing, it'd be in the comic. Cause mm-hmm. like it's free to draw a tank. It's not free to put a tank in, you know, in the thing, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, making the TV show, like, he definitely had the context of almost a decade since having written the first issues and, like, knowing where things are leading, you're able to, like, better seed things or set things up or retool characters in a way that, like, kind of fits more for a TV show.
Which is funny because season two of the TV show is, like, a mess. But
I haven't made it that far.
Wait, how far did you get, Emily, in the TV show?
I only watched the first season, and I didn't.
Oh, okay.
The more that it diverged, right. And then like once they got to the CDC in Atlanta, and I was like, that didn't fucking happen at all. Yeah, I didn't like that. Well, so.
Something similar happens much later, but yeah.
Okay, maybe yeah, but what, I
what's,
just
what's season two?
I was just at the like when I was like 17 and 18, I like had I just had a like a. Like a source material supremacy issue where like if I read a book and I liked the book and then they made an adaptation of the book and they did things differently, I couldn't evaluate it on its own merits. I would just be like, they changed the thing that I like, so I don't like it. Which is not like it's not a good way to evaluate things, but I can say that with 15 years of distance.
We've all been there.
But I only made it through the first season.
Yeah. The CDC scene at the end of the first season is they find themselves in like the CDC building in Atlanta because mm-hmm. it was like supposed to be some sort of safe haven. Mm-hmm. And while they're there, that's when they find out that all of them will, like, even if they're not bitten, when they die, they'll come back. They'll be zombified.
Oh, like if they die of natural causes, they'll turn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that reveal doesn't come like much later in the comic.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
No, but season two of the TV show is like, I think it's like three episodes at the beginning. And then it's like 20 episodes of them all on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Like they stretch it out for a really long time.
Oh,
and it's like
so
this
it's
constant like
it's like Kirkman took preemptively took my complaints about how fast things go on the farm and was like, okay, I'm gonna stretch this out, but he took too much time. Gotta find a happy medium, Robert.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I remember because I was watching the show at the time. That I read the comic, and the first thing obviously is that they kill Shane at the end of the first arc in the comic, and Shane is alive until the season two finale.
Well, that's because it was on Bernthal, right? Like,
yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you're not gonna. Mm. I mean, they realized they fucked up when they only kept Michael Rooker around for like three episodes.
Yeah.
At the beginning, like, dude,
was he only in like three episodes?
Yeah, They kill him like pretty quick. Maybe he's in season two briefly, but they kill him pretty quick.
I didn't watch it far. I don't know.
I mean, we got a.
I just felt like he was like a big deal, so that it surprises me that
his brother.
I met him once. He was super nice.
Hmm.
Michael Rooker? Yeah, I met him at a comic convention one time. He was really nice.
Michael Rooker is awesome.
It was like right after the first Guardians movie.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. He was super nice.
We did get Norman Reedus out of it, which is cool.
True.
Norman Reedus is a cool guy. I'm glad he's out of Walking Dead jail.
Has he done any acting other than Walking Dead recently?
Hideo Kojima's Death Stranding.
Okay, all right.
He actually has a movie coming out that he starred in where he plays like a biker, And I think that looks pretty good. And I want to say I saw him in something else recently, too.
While you're Googling that, I'm going to tell you guys, I've probably told you this before, or maybe I haven't. When I was in Japan, I saw a doujinshi, for the uninitiated, is a fan comic. They have a reputation, or like a Japanese fan comic specifically. They have a reputation for being smutty, but that's not a rule. That's just like a popular association, especially with the word in English. But I found a Walking Dead doujinshi that had like a dog boy Norman Reedus on the cover.
Okay, so I know what it is now. It's not anything recent, but okay. I watched Blade 2 on the plane, and Norman Reedus is in Blade 2.
That's cool. Fun. So, have you ever seen Boondock Saints?
I've never seen Boondock Saints.
No. Oh, you should see Boondock Saints. I mean, like, I don't know that I don't know if I can say it's good because it's been so long since I saw it, but I know a lot of people liked it, including me.
Yeah.
Back in the
day. Unfortunately, Daryl Dixon and by extent Norman Reedus, he's not.
Well, yeah, I know there's the show where he washes up in Paris or whatever.
He washes up in Paris?
Well, not Paris, because Paris isn't a coastal city, but he washes up on the French beach.
Oh, that's really funny.
I don't know how he got that. Like, I don't
Daryl
know.
Daryl Dixon washes ashore in France and sets to return to America.
Yeah.
That's really funny.
Whoa. I don't know. I assume, like, Walking Dead must end with him, like, on a boat or something, but I don't know how he gets. Maybe he just floated all the way from. I couldn't tell you what happens there because I stopped watching around season 4.
Unfortunately, we should probably wrap up soon.
We should wrap up soon.
Yes. Just like The Walking Dead.
We're hearing the
we're sound going on for way too long, just like The Walking Dead.
Yep. And unlike The Walking Dead, we're hearing the sound of the Doomsday Clock, which is telling Jeff us Jones. It's time to end the show. Well, not end the show, but, you know, do the segment at the end of the show, which is the cry space.
We decided to stop at 48 and not 50. We're done. It's the final episode.
Much like Robert Kirkman, yeah.
Since we referenced my cry space in the beginning, I'll just go ahead and go first. I don't know if I've mentioned on the show that I'm moving, but I'm moving, and I had my very last appointment with the hairdresser who has been doing my hair since I started dyeing it, almost 10 years.
Whoa.
So I had my last appointment with her yesterday, and it was emotional, and we didn't cry, but almost, but she did something very cool with my hair as a send off, and but I'm excited because even though this is a sad moment, there's also happy because she has a friend who is a stylist in Minneapolis, which is right next to where I'm going to be moving to, who uses literally the exact same hair dye, so I don't even have to worry about it. I am still gonna be able to get me, because I'm very particular about the hair dye specifically, like the shade of green. I'm very picky about it, so I'm glad that I don't have to just search for someone who also uses this specific dye.
Heck yeah,
that is very fair.
But that's my cry space, is that I'm gonna miss Alicia.
Alex, do you have one prepared?
I've been, so last episode, 2 weeks ago, I was saying that I started playing Marvel Snap, you know, as a bit, as a joke, but now I'm level 72 and I want to get level 100 and get that shiny card before the month is done. So, yeah.
Your cry space that you're addicted to a card game.
I think I'm addicted to it. Yeah. I haven't played Hearthstone in a while though. So it's kind of back and forth, but
it's better than Hearthstone. So
the issue, the thing about Hearthstone Battlegrounds is you have like 30 seconds to a minute and a half between turns where you can like not do it. Uh-huh. Whereas Marvel Snap is like the turns take like 6 to 10 seconds generally, sometimes longer, like at most 20. So there's no downtime and it's 6 turns. So yeah. It's kind of like if you're playing Marvel Snap, you're only doing Marvel Snap, and I don't know. It's
Have you guys played Balatro?
No. I don't know how to play poker, so. No.
It's like poker meets Slay the Spire, is what Gwen said, so.
Yeah.
I've heard very good things.
As have I.
Very good things.
I hear that it's very addictive. I can't play card games, so.
I play too much Magic to let any other card games into my life.
You played Marvel Snap a year ago.
I think that's...
I did play Marvel Snap. Yeah.
My wife cut Magic out of their life, so I think they're filling filling the hole with other card games.
Yeah. Your wife should get back into Magic. But I understand why you wouldn't want to get back into Magic.
There's a laundry list of reasons why not, and then as for wanting to, it's
oh fun. Yeah, I'm on like a Magic high right now though.
The local comic and card shop in the place that we're going to be moving to apparently has Lorcana nights, which I think is really funny. I didn't realize there was enough of a demand.
No, my game store has Lorcana. They have Lorcana events.
Oh, is it Lorcana?
I don't know if it's Lorcana. I've already said Lorcana.
Yeah, it's probably Lorcana.
They do a constructed and a limited event. Like on, they have two weeks for it, and they're adding a Star Wars Unlimited night too.
You're doing Star Wars Unlimited, right? As well, you're giving it a go.
I have given it a go. I thought it was pretty fun. I'm gonna go. It's on Thursday, so I'm gonna go. I have a friend who I'm gonna borrow a deck from and play on Thursday.
Nice,
that's fun.
But yeah, no, I'm on a. Yeah, my cry space. I had one, and then the next day I had another one. So on Sunday, I went and saw... I'm only going to do one, but on Sunday I went and saw End of Evangelion on the big screen, which was incredible. I highly recommend doing... Well, I guess by the time this comes out, you won't be able to do it anymore because the days will be over.
Buy a bigger TV.
So, yeah, exactly. But no, it was... truly an incredible experience. It was a packed theater, but you could hear a pin drop when the third impact sequence started up. Like, I just got chills at that moment, and then actually cried when during the scene where Shinji and Rei are like post third impact, when all of humanity's consciousness has been kind of melded into one, and they're in the pool of LCL, talking to one another. And yeah, it was a great experience. There was an Asuka cosplayer. That was cool. But it was very good. I cried.
I had a relevant sound clip. I love Evangelion. And I did play it, but it's actually very quiet. So I'm going to bump up the volume so I can make you guys hear it.
So fucked up.
Uh-huh. I still didn't hear it.
Oh,
so
it's
fucked up.
I heard someone whisper, but
it's Shinji saying "I'm so fucked up" from the infamous the only scene. If you haven't seen End of Evangelion, that you probably know about it.
Yes.
I will just say last thing is that I thought your cry space was going to be Jean-Luc that Apex Legends esports event got hacked and they had to not. It was the finals and they
that
had
was
to
insane.
Postpone it.
No, so I got home from watching End of Eva and I was like, all right, I'm going to watch the VOD of this of the Apex North American Regional Finals because they were happening at the same time. And I turn on the VOD and I see like all the streamers are offline. So I'm like, oh, it must have finished. Perfect. So I start watching it. And I watch like the first three games, and then the commentators get to that point, and I hadn't like looked at Twitter or Reddit or anything because I didn't want to be spoiled on it. And then I got to it, and I immediately looked on the subreddit for competitive Apex, and it was like, multiple players got hacked mid game and had.
Oh, I hadn't heard about this. That's insane.
Oh yeah. So the hacker like hacked their game, typed a bunch of shit in the in-game chat, and then turned on aimbot for the players to make it look like they were cheating. There's some really funny clips.
That's insane. Where
there's so a cool. really funny clip where the IGL for TSM starts shooting. He realizes he goes, I'm cheating, but he doesn't stop shooting. And then he says, and then his teammates are yelling at him, like, leave the game. So and he just goes, what if I don't shoot? What if I just don't shoot? And then he's one of his teammates gets knocked and he starts rezzing him, and the door to the building they're in opens, and he just gets off the rez, turns around, like 181 clips the guy who walked into the door. And then after He said, I don't know if that's cheating or if it's just controller aim assist. And you know what? Truer words have never been spoken. Right?
Oh, that's so funny.
What is the difference? But yeah, it is obviously like pretty shitty that it happened, but it is at least very funny. I probably will cry more of laughter than of actual sadness.
Hey, look, okay. The cry space does not make any demands of what type of tears you have.
Exactly. But it is pretty funny. But I think that'll do it for this episode of Crying in the Book Club. You can find us on Twitter at Crying Book Club. I'm at Mountain Dew Liker. Emily is at mpandanata. Alex is at Alex Hansiak. Emily and I are on Letterboxd. I am JL Botville. Emily is Pandabore, also Pandabore on Twitch, and has a veritable podcasting empire, including such shows as Imagine Me and Utena, Fresh Podcast Market, and That Looks Terrible. And you can catch us in 2 weeks' time when we will talk about a book that Emily will have to say the name of, because I don't know it off the top of my head. But we are
reading a one-shot manga called The Wise Beasts of the Wizarding Wilds.
It's some furry shit. So
it's some furry wizard school shit, and I'm excited for John to hate it. And for
Emily is doing this to torture me.
I'm really not. It's just the first thing I could think of that's a one-shot, and we needed something short.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. But, I'm sure it's fine.
I mean,
it can't be worse than Beastars, so.
Oh, eat a dick. but it's a collection of short stories set in a wizarding school, and the characters are anthropomorphic animals, and I think it's cute. So I'm excited for us to read it, and John's probably going to hate it, but it's fine.
And in 1 month's probably time, not. Our big 50th episode with guest stars galore.
Oh god, I guess we gotta plan something for episode 50, huh?